I'd like to read it again just to remind us concerning Moses. You know, I never think of praying for the President of the United States, but I think of the time that I stayed in a home in Iowa, and when I arrived there, the brother and sister in the home were there, and he hadn't been too well, and they told me that just the week before, Mrs. Hillary Clinton had called to the home just to see how the man was doing. And, of course, I like to shock Brother Slaybaugh. He's not very shockable, so I told him the story when he arrived, and, of course, he thought I was just joking, but I wasn't. The daughter of that couple, I met her one time just after she had been chief of staff of the governor of the state of Ohio, and from there she went to Washington and was a one that was a consultant for and still is for President Clinton, and very high up in government there, not saved, into Eastern mysticism, breaking the hearts of her parents, and I often think of her that she needs our prayers. Carolyn Lukensmeyer is her name, a daughter of our brother and sister in the Hampton Assembly, Jerry and Jean Lukensmeyer. If you have a place to pray for, it breaks their hearts to think of someone who knows so much and knows so little. So I often think of that. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 23, by faith Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 years, or 3 months rather, of his parents, because they saw he was a proper child, and they were not afraid of the king's commandment. By faith Moses, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of the reward. By the way, we might look at verse 26 and think of the treasures of Egypt as a small thing. They were not. One of the least known pharaohs of the different dynasties was one that we know best, and that was King Tutankhamun. I have a book on his treasures at home. And the coffin, he was a boy king, died young. The coffin that he was in, made of solid gold, worth millions of dollars, and that was only one item among many, and he was a, if I can say it, a very ordinary pharaoh, and so at great cost, Moses saw something richer. You know what I think when I think of that, and I might as well tell you now, I didn't plan to minister right at the moment, but I might as well tell you now. When Moses gave up so much, why is it that we find so hard to give up so little? None of us will ever come close to that. Why do we waste our time on petty things? Why do we? Say, why do you? I ask myself that question too sometimes. I don't know. It's because we've lost sight of something. Let's go to the book of Acts chapter 7. Acts chapter 7. And reading at verse 20. Acts 7 verse 20, we have Stephen's address to the nation of Israel, in which time Moses was born. Here Stephen's giving history and teaching from it. In which time Moses was born, was exceeding fair, and nourished up in his father's house 3 months. When he was cast out, Pharaoh's daughter took him up and nourished him for her own son. And Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and he was mighty in words and deeds. And when he was full 40 years old, it came into his heart. I want you to notice that with me. It came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. and seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended him and avenged him that was oppressed and smote the Egyptian. Here's what's on my mind as well, verse 25, the beginning. Well, it really is the whole verse, actually. For he supposed his brethren would have understood how that God by his hand would deliver them, but they understood not. Now, the reason I read this is because it shows that somehow at this point in time, Moses actually understood that he was going to be the deliverer. He seemed to know that. It was something he understood that they thought. He thought they would understand. Now, let's go over to Exodus to chapter 1. Exodus chapter 1. And let's read it, verse 16. And he said, when you do the office of a midwife to the Hebrew women, seat him upon the stools. If it be a son, then ye shall kill him. But if it be a daughter, then she shall live. But the midwives feared God and did not as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the men's children alive. Now, chapter 2 and verse 1. Well, let's read verse 22 for a moment. Verse 22, and Pharaoh charged all his people, saying, every son that is born he shall cast into the river, and every daughter he shall save alive. Verse 1 of chapter 2, and there went a man of the house of Levi and took to wife a daughter of Levi. And the woman conceived and bare a son, and when she saw him that he was a goodly child, she hid him 3 months. Now, I think that's all we'll read at the moment. You might have noticed that in chapter 7 of Acts, it talks about the father's house. In Hebrews 11, it talks about the parents, both involved. And here the emphasis seems to be on the women. Now, I want to suggest something to you. You may have heard it before, you may not. In Luke chapter 13, there's a well-known passage that we often preach in the gospel. It says, when once the master of the house has risen up and shut to the door, and you begin to knock. That's a well-known passage. The word master of the house tells us that the man is the head of the house. The word there in the Greek, I don't often say much about Greek because it is of no interest to most people, but the word there in the Greek is the word from which we get our word despot. It does not mean despot in the Greek. Sometimes we have a problem with reverse etymology. We try to take an English meaning and put it back into a Greek word. That's not the way it operates. The Greeks had the word first and we brought it out of English, so we can't take our meaning and put it back in. But that's the word from which we get our English word despot, the ruler of the house. Here is something that's very interesting. When you come to 1 Timothy chapter 5, it says concerning the younger women, they are to guide the house. In the Greek language, it is actually the same as Luke 13, the master of the house. I said to Brother Slaybaugh one time, I said, Brother, we spend a lot of time together. He and I are great friends. I love him a lot. But like I told you, he's hard to shock, so I like to try and shock him a little bit. I said, Brother, do you believe that the man is the head of the home? He said, I do. Very emphatically, if you know him at all, he's definite. There's no black, there's no gray with him, black or white. I said, the scriptures don't teach that. He said, of course they do. I said, well, where would you get it? He said, well, you know where you get it, Ephesians 5. I said, show me. So we turned to Ephesians 5, and he read it to me. The husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church. I said, so where does it say he's head of the home? Well, he said, right there. I said, no, it doesn't. It says he's head of the wife. I said, the woman is the head of the home. said, where do you get that? I said, find it for yourself. And I kind of think he did. And then he had the nerve to preach at a conference. He said, if you have any more questions about it, ask Brother Beattie. I thought, you said it, you defend it. But let me give you an illustration of this, because this really relates to what we're talking about. The women have prominence here. When I worked in the hospital, I worked as a medical technologist. I was head of hematology. The pathologist and the assistant pathologist were head of me. Really, I worked with the assistant pathologist, and he was the one that I reported to day after day, and we discussed things that needed to be talked about. He was my head, but he was not head of hematology. I was. So, Duff, what difference does it make? Well, a brother said to me about 3 or 4 years ago, he said, you know, Brother Jim, he said, I make decisions, and I can't get my wife to stand behind me in the home. And I looked at him, and I said, I hope she never does. I said, what do you mean? I said, she's head of the home, you stand behind her. See, when I worked in the hematology department, if I made a decision, the pathologist, although he was above me, and ultimately he was responsible, finally, for decisions that were made in the whole region of the lab, still, when I made a decision, he stood behind me. I can remember one time we had kind of an ornery gal that worked in the department. She was very hard to control. I don't like controlling people at all, and I don't control women. I told someone today, we've been married 31 years, my wife and I, last week. I have yet to tell her to do anything. I've never said, you must do this or that. We don't have that kind of relationship. We don't need to. So I'm not a person who loves to control people, but this one you couldn't have if you wanted to. But one day we were having something going on, and he walked out of his office, and he walked into the department, and he saw I was busy with the situation. He just walked back out. He did not take over, and afterwards he asked me what happened. I told him, and he says, I stand behind you. Now, I could ask him to come in and take over. That would be fine. But brethren and sisters, we need to recognize that God has given a public headship to men in the assembly and over their wives. But God has given a private headship to women, and our sisters do know how to run a home better than a man. They are not more than men or less than men. They are different from men. And we need to trust our wives and guide and help them. I'm not trying to take away headship from men. Don't get the wrong impression. But there needs to be, I guess you would call it, a balance here, a state of balance, or what we would call equipoise. We need a state of balance here where there's a teaming together. I want to tell you, where there's failure on the part of our sisters to guide the home, where there's failure on the part of our brethren to stand behind their wives in the home and take headship of the wife and help guide and develop her in her work, and she's supporting us, it turns into tragedy. Let me tell you, I could tell you stories of particular people, and the outcome is, because of weak men and women trying to take a place that God has not given them, you end up with very, very unhappy children. Bitter. I went to a home one night because a sister suggested I go and visit her son, married son. And I want to tell you, when I left that place, I feared for my life. I don't often get that way. But that man was ferocious. And he was bitter, bitter, bitter against all Christians. Do you know what it was from? A father who would say nothing and take no responsibility, and a mother who tried to do it all. There needs to be balance. And I think that's what we have in Hebrews chapter 11. In chapter 11, the parents saw he was a goodly child. Here in the historical record, it says that she saw in verse 2 of chapter 2 that he was a goodly child. And I think that there was a working together and a standing together. Let me encourage that in our lives together as husbands and wives. I'm bringing that up because I said I would try to get a whole broad of teaching, range of teaching from the ministry that I'm taking up here. I want to go back for a minute to what we read in chapter 1. First of all, Pharaoh tried to get the parents, or the midwives rather, who were delivering the children, to kill them, to throw them into the river. When that wouldn't work, then he said to his own people, he charged his own people in the last verse, that every son that is born ye shall cast into the river. And listen, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, is a picture of the god of this world. The river was a god to the Egyptians too. It was the source of life, of their life. In Egypt, it was the source of their life. Brothers and sisters, materialism in North America is where the people of this world are drawing their life from. They're trying to get everything that will meet their needs in material possessions. Now, as I think I mentioned last night, there's nothing wrong with education. But ultimately, we need to get our sights back on the fact that we are here for eternity. That's what we're here for nothing else. This is only a short time. And those who have lived longest will tell you how quickly time passes and how soon things that seemed important at one time seem so insignificant. Talking to a sister the other day, 91 years of age, I said, "That's a long time." She says, "It hardly seems like it." And I'm 54 now. The older I get, the more I realize that not much matters in this world. Not really. Now, they only had a short time. Let's go on to chapter 2. They only had a short time with Moses where they could completely keep him from being exposed to the reality that he was alive at all. But then God gave them a further opportunity. Now, before I get at that, let me point out something here, because I believe history is theology. Verse 1 says, "There went a man of the house of Levi and took to wife a daughter of Levi." Now, there is no commentary about that. We cannot draw conclusions if that's all we had to read. And they did marry back and forth between the other tribes. You find that in the last chapter of Numbers 20, of Numbers, I think it's chapter 26. It's the last chapter anyway of Numbers. And the daughters of Zelophehad had wondered about marrying to other tribes. It was proper. It was all right. But here's a principle I see. This man took a woman who had a common background. They had something in common. And can I speak to younger believers here? Even if you're very young and you don't even know boys exist yet, and there is a time when that happens, way back when they're very little, even if you are like that, let me tell you, when the time comes, if you think about it, don't even think, if you're a child of God, of even looking twice at an unsaved man. I could tell you, and the older believers could tell you, tragic heartache. Can I say something to those in their teens and maybe in their 20s who are still single? If you have someone in your school or college or work of the opposite sex who claims to be interested in the gospel, don't evangelize them. And I have no reservation about saying that. You say, you mean you let them go down to hell? No. Bring them out to a meeting and put them in the hands of those of the same sex. Now, I know sometimes it works out without doing that. But I have also known stories where, in fact, two recent ones that I was involved in helping with, where people tried to evangelize those of the opposite sex, their emotions got involved, the person professed to be saved. I don't believe they were saved at all. I believe they can be, but they weren't saved in these cases, and it has turned into ruin. It really can. I was at a conference where a brother said the opposite and disagreed when I said that, and he said, right in this audience, there are people who have evangelized those of the opposite sex, and it's turned out fine. I said, I know. I said, I've been to Niagara Falls. I like history. And I know that some people have gone over the falls and survived, but I still don't recommend the trip. I'm serious. You put someone in the hands of someone of the same sex and let them look after. In fact, the brother that brother was referring to, I had supper with him later, about several months later, in his home, and I said to him, you were in the audience that day, what do you think? You were saved from the outside through your wife. He said, she did exactly what you said. She brought me out to the meeting. He said, I didn't want to come. I was coming for her. He said, I didn't want to come. I was coming for her. She brought me out, introduced me to some of these men, and he said, I was so mad because he said she'd come into the meetings after that and she wouldn't even blink at me. And he said she wouldn't look at me, she wouldn't go out for supper with me, had nothing to do with me, you'd think she had never met me. But he got saved by the grace of God, because after coming out and seeing her conviction, he said, there's something real to this. And so she did testify by her life. Be really careful. Let me go further. He married within the same tribe. Marriage in the Lord, to me, not only means marrying someone in assembly fellowship, that's just the beginning. To me, it means marrying someone who has bowed to the lordship of the Lord Jesus Christ and has the same interests. Because I hate to say it, brother and sisters, let's face it, we've got some carnal Christians amongst us. And you marry one of those, even if they're in the assembly, you may have a different set of values from what they have. You really could. So I don't think just, you say, well, you believe in marrying someone within the assembly. I believe a lot more than that. Pray about it. Try to ask the Lord. Don't try. Ask Him to guide you into meeting someone who has the same goals in life within the assembly. This man, I'm not drawing all of that out of here. I'm just pointing out that he took a wife of the same tribe, same values, common interest, and you see the outcome of it. Now, notice verse 2. She saw him, that he was a goodly child, and she hid him 3 months. And when she could not longer hide him, she took for him an ark of bulrushes and daubed it with slime and with pitch, and she put the child therein, and she laid it in the flags by the river's brink. Let me suggest something here. I don't know anything about the Christians here, what you do, but I'm finding that the question comes up constantly back in Ontario, Christian schooling versus the public school system. I'm not going to get into that, but I'll tell you this. The home has more influence than anything else. You know, when we moved down to Bothwell, some Christians came to us and said, don't move there. It's an old assembly. There are no children for your children, no one to play with. Why don't you go to London Assembly, big assembly, there'll be somebody for your children, and you'll they'll have friends and you'll see them saved. It's, you know, it's not a good idea to go down there. I said, well, that would be great. I said, we moved to London. We go down to Newbury. We find that there's one or two families there and they have children. And I get up and I preach some time to them and say, you can raise your children for God even in this place. I said, what a hypocrite. Oh, yeah, I go to the safe place. I go to London. But I come down and tell you, you can do it, but don't ask me to do it. I said, I don't ask people to do anything I'm not willing to do. So we'll move down to Bothwell. They say, well, there's nothing there for your children in the assembly. I say, thank God. Thank God. God did not ask the children, the assembly to raise my children. He didn't. You say there's nothing in the assembly for the young people? I say, thank God. Because then it's going according to the pattern. I don't see anything in Scripture where God expected the assembly to raise our children. I said, we will raise our children. And I don't believe all statistics, of course, but there's a book by a man called Dr. Ross Campbell, Christian psychologist, and the book is called How to Really Love Your Children or Your Child, and then he has another book, How to Really Love Your Teenager. And in it he says, the home wins over every other influence without a fight. Brothers and sisters, our greatest need is to model Christianity in the home. I remember when our Paul was going through a difficult time, he was in contact with social services at one point, and we won't get into why about that, but he asked if we would see this gal. She was in her 40s, and I said, sure. She came to the house. She said to me, she said, don't worry about your son. She said, the time will come when he'll be so like you, and she pointed to me, that it'll be scary. I remember the day that our daughter-in-law, Becky, called. She was mad. She said, Dad, can I speak to Mom? Paul's acting just like you, and I want to know what she does. Well, that solved that problem. I said, just wait till I get her on the phone. I don't even know what the problem was. Brothers and sisters, model Christianity in the home. Now, they protected as long as they could, but the time came when they could no longer protect. Let me say this. If your exercise is a Christian home or homeschooling, you're going to get no flack from me. I'm just saying, if you can't afford it or you don't feel that you want to go that route, I think God can save your children wherever they are. But there needs to be deep exercise, and that's what we will see here. Notice what it says. When they could no longer hide him, verse 3, he took for him an ark of bulrushes and daubed it with slime and with pitch and put the child therein and laid it in the flags by the river's brink. Now here's what she did. She took the child and put that child in the very same place that was death to other children. But she put the child in after making provision that river would not drown the child. And brothers and sisters, here they were in the home. They're looking down the road and they're saying, now the time is going to come when we're not going to be able to keep this child hidden anymore. Because after all, as the child gets bigger, it's going to start walking around, it's going to start growing up, and they'll say, there's a Hebrew child. So it wasn't possible to keep that child hidden the whole time. But they started making preparation for that day, making sure that there was waterproofing, adequate protection, so the child would float in the same place where other children had been lost. As we are raising our children, we should be putting every single effort that we can into guiding them for God. If we are careless, guiding children, and they didn't take Moses and put him right out into the stream, they put them just at the edge. Sometimes parents have said to me, you know, they want to get involved in school activities. What am I supposed to do? And some of them really don't care. I'm afraid I have to say that. They really don't. And they say, well, you can't stop it. That's true. They couldn't stop moving the child out, but they didn't dump the child in the middle. And my recommendation is to parents, try to keep them at the edge of all this as much as you can. And you have to be exercised about how you will do that, but keep them at the edge. Did that end the matter? Let's read down. Verse 4. And his sister stood afar off to wit what would be done to him. And the daughter of Pharaoh came down to wash herself at the river, and her maidens walked along by the river's side. And when she saw the ark among the flags, she sent her maid to fetch it. And when she had opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the babe wept. And she had compassion on him, and said, this is one of the Hebrew children. Then said his sister to Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and call to thee a nurse of the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for thee? And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, go. And the maid went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said unto her, take this child away and nurse it for me, and I will give thee thy wages. And the mother took the child and nursed it. You know what I see here? I see several things, of course, but one thing I see is I don't really know whether they planned purposely to put the child there. I can't tell you that. Thinking about it, I'm inclined to think maybe they did. I don't know. But I can see this, that even when they had to step back and it was no longer in their hands, they did not become careless. I mean, you think how they were right there, and they had been doing some thinking, and if you want to call Moses' sister Miriam quick thinking, that would be fine with me. Maybe it was exercise and prayer before they got there and said, Lord, show us what to do if something happens. But they're standing back, and they're watching, and they're not neglectful. And the whole time, through all that was in their hands, they never, for a moment, let down their responsibility. Brothers and sisters, we need always to be on guard, all the time, in the lives of guiding our family, and never grow weary in the responsibility of getting them through until they're on their own. There came a moment when Moses was a man on his own, and he had to make some choices. But until that time, they did everything possible to make sure that they did their part. Now, there's some things they couldn't do. God took care of those. But there was real vigilance here, real care to make sure they did what they could. But here's another side. I believe, brothers and sisters, if we do our part, God will do His. Sometimes God does His part even when we don't do ours. He's a God of grace. But tell me something. What touches a woman's heart about a baby more than anything else? You say, well, a baby crying. Exactly. God caused the baby to cry at the right moment. I want you to think about this for a moment with me. Western civilization that we live in is based upon the Judeo-Christian ethic. Where did it come from? It came from Moses and from the Ten Commandments. The civilization, brethren and sisters, that you and I presently enjoy, it's deteriorating, but the civilization we presently enjoy, we can thank Moses' mother and sister for. Think of the thousands of years that have passed, and you and I are reaping the benefit of their exercise. Wouldn't it be wonderful if the Lord be not come, that 200 years from now, there's a thriving testimony in Winnipeg because the present parents here are burdened and watching and making sure that their children are guided into salvation and scriptural paths, and 200 years from now they can look back and maybe there'll be old pictures of you and I on the wall, and they'll say, because of that person and their burden and their sacrifice, we are reaping the benefit today. You find that in the days of Jeremiah, when they tried to get some men to drink wine, and they looked back and they said, no, our father way back in Israel wouldn't drink, and he made us promise we never would. And several hundred years later, they still won't touch wine because of respect for a father. These women, brothers and sisters, have given you and I personal blessing. They really have. The Ten Commandments came because two women made a sacrifice and they determined they were going to preserve a child. The other side of it is that babe wept. And here's a lesson for us. When there are things that we cannot control and cannot bring to pass, we need to look to God to expect Him to do what we can't do. And that's what happened here. The babe cries. Notice what it says in verse 6. And she had compassion on him. Now, I don't know what would have happened if she would have been what we would have called one of the ordinary Egyptians. I don't know. But here, somehow, either through exercise of the women, it is Pharaoh's daughter that finds the child. Isn't that wonderful? Romans 11, verse 33 says, oh, the depths of the wisdom, of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are His judgments and His ways past finding out. Let me encourage you, brothers and sisters, to trust God. Maybe there's someone here tonight, and I don't know you well enough to know, maybe there's an impossible situation in your life. I love what Job says at the end of his book, the book about him. He says, I know that thou canst do everything. Everything. And brothers and sisters, God can use a baby's cry to change the world. And that's what He did here. Nothing is insignificant with God. And they make sure that they offer a good babysitter, and the mother gets the baby back. Isn't that wonderful how that works out? Let's go down a little further. Verse 11. And it came to pass in those days when Moses was grown, that he went out unto his brethren and looked on their burdens. And he spied an Egyptian smiting an Hebrew, one of his brethren. Now we read in Acts chapter 7, it came into his heart. Here's Moses, and he is beginning to take his responsibility. You know, one of our greatest needs today among God's people is those who come out and look on the burdens of other believers. You know, it's not new, brothers and sisters. I was reading recently, I think it's in 2 Corinthians, Paul says to the Corinthians, he says, you have many teachers. Maybe it's 1 Corinthians, but anyway, he says, you have many teachers, but he said, you don't have many fathers. What we need today, brethren, sisters, fathers, and mothers. I was talking to a sister at the Rose Isle Conference, and she said she was a certain place. And she said all around there were sisters needing help. And she said, I saw older sisters. And I may be stepping on toes here. I'm not meaning to. I'm just telling you what I feel. She said there were older sisters in that place. And their husbands had good jobs, making good money. And their homes were paid for. And these women are off to work every day, getting money that they don't need, while God's people are languishing. Brothers and sisters, we need sisters amongst us, mothers in Israel. We really do. My wife went to a place recently, and I talked to her on the phone yesterday, I guess it was. She said to me, she said, "I'm not bitter, and I'm not going to let myself get bitter, but my wife drove 120 miles to be a mother for a few days to a sister because of needy circumstances. And in that area where my wife went, I'm thinking that there are 50 sisters my wife's age and older within 10 miles of that sister. And not one of them, not one in 3 years has ever been inside the home." Can I encourage the older sisters, as Titus tells us to? Titus chapter 2 tells us to. It says that the older women, the aged women, are to teach the younger women. There is a scriptural work for sisters to do. You know, I don't know, maybe it's not a need here, but there are some places where there are sisters who are very old and they've got arthritis and they can't even comb their own hair, and they would just love for someone to come and comb their hair and fix it up and tidy them up and help them a little bit so they could look nice for a day. And it's a work that could be done. And brethren, again, I don't know the need here. This is off the top of my head. There are single sisters in some places, or young widows, and their boys need a male role model. Someone who will go out and play baseball with them, or take them out for the day, go fishing with them, or whatever. And we need to get beyond our own needs and look around to see that there are others who have needs of those helping them, so that they turn out to be men of God too. Again, recently I've been talking to two different sisters, single moms, and they're just longing that some brother would call up and say, "Can I take your boy out for a day?" You know, I know in one place a sister called up big brothers. And this boy has a big brother. And you know what I think of that? You say, do you think it's wrong? No, I think it's a shame that we have to go outside. God intended that this be the social services of the Christians, and every need could be met within. And I'm not reprimanding you. I hope I'm not. I'm not planning to or intending to. But I want to give you some food for thought. Brothers and sisters, coming through these doors, and you know that, and going home and shaking hands and talking for a few minutes is not where it begins and ends. This is not where it begins and ends. And you say, well, you know, I'm an older person. No kid would want to play with me, as we say. My wife says, don't say kid, they're children. But I'm just trying to say what you might say. Listen, recently I was in a place, and 54 years old, 14-year-old boy shook hands with me at the door. He said, "Mr. Beattie, you haven't come over and spent time with me for a while." And I thought to myself, well, we're 40 years difference, but I have spent time with him before. I said, "I'll be in touch." Talked to a brother. He's got a sailing boat. And I said, "Listen," I said, "how about next week we take the boy out sailing?" And we did. On the way back, my car ran out of gas. And that's unusual, because the needle was not on empty. And I think God controls the fuel lines, you know, too. And we sat by the side of the road. I had my cell phone on me, and I called a brother, and he came and with gas. But while I was sitting there, I just happened to turn to the boy. I said, "You know, I haven't talked to you for a long time about being saved. Are you still thinking about it some?" He said, "Yes," as if, "Don't you know?" I said, "Really?" He said, "Yes." I said, "How often do you think about it?" He says, "Every day." I said, "Would you like to be saved?" He said, "Yes." I said, "When?" He said, "Now." I said, "Well, listen, we'll get the gas. I'll take you back over toward your home, but we won't go home because you got brothers there, and they will be bothering us as we try to talk. I said, we'll go off to McDonald's. And we went off to McDonald's, and within an hour and a half, that boy was really saved. I want to tell you, that day paid off. Brothers and sisters, we need to be with God's people. We need shepherds today. We've always needed them. I think of Philippians chapter 2. Paul said to the Philippians concerning Timothy, I have no man like-minded who will naturally care for your souls. For all seek their own, not the things that are Jesus Christ. As I stop, let me ask you, brothers and sisters, what interests me? What am I seeking? You say, well, preachers, they always seek the right things. Oh, don't I wish? Listen, I've got a heart like yours. I can be as selfish as anybody. What are you living for? What am I living for? I'll tell you something. 100 years from now, most of the things that we're taking an interest in, they won't even matter. 100 years from now, they won't even matter. But if you can look around the gates, through the gates of heaven and around in heaven and say, there's someone there because I was a blessing to them, not in a proud way, but in a humble way, I'll tell you it'll be worth it. Brothers and sisters, let's go in for what matters. We'll talk about Moses, Lord willing, tomorrow night and how he went out further, but he saw the burdens of his brethren. That's what moved him. He was in a comfortable place, but his comfort did not take his heart away from his brethren. It was in his heart, and that's what motivated him. Let's pray.